We know how they go.
Good afternoon. I'll call the House Education Finance Committee to order. And I don't know if has anyone had a chance to look at the minutes? Oh, a quorum is present. We have Representative Mary Frances participating remotely today, Mary Frances Clardy. And let's see here. I see Representative Hudson looking at the minutes. Do they look okay, Representative Hudson? Would you like to move the minutes?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Representative Hudson moves the minutes for March 18th, 2025. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The minutes are adopted. With that, members, I have two vehicle bills similar to what we had when Representative Cresha passed his out that I'll just present from the gavel. The first one we're going to stick in Ways and Means, and the second one we're sending to taxes. We just want to make sure that Chair Cresha and I have all the options that we need to get this across the finish line. So, members, I'll move House File 1048 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. This bill just, of course, I forgot my own bill folders. This bill just has, I'll have Mr. Strong. You're the one that wrote this, so I should let you explain it. So.
Madam Chair, members, as you mentioned, this is just a vehicle bill on line 1.9. Inserts a missing word, the word adjusted for the pupil unit. It doesn't change anything in practice. That's how the revenue calculation is currently being made by the Department of Education, but it puts a missing word in statute.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I was just going to read off the summary, and then I felt guilty about taking other people's work. So with that, members, are there any questions for House File 1048? Seeing none, I will take a vote on 1048. All those in favor, the motion is to move it to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. House File 1048 is we referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Yes, I'm out of practice. House File 1049. Mr. Strom, do you want to tackle this one too, please? This will be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, House File 1049 also has no practical effect on lines 1.7. Just clarifies that the library aid is for school districts that are independent or special school districts. That's all of our operating school districts in Minnesota. So clarifies that that's the group that it applies to. Again, no practical change.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Members, are there any questions on House File 1049? Then I'll renew my motion to move 1049 to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say no. With that, House File 1049 is re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All right, members, thank you for your patience. With that, our first bill on the agenda today is House File 745. I want to thank Chair Cresha for giving us some time to have an overview on compensatory aid. That was super helpful as we move into this bill. And with that, and that groundwork laid, I'll welcome Representative Feist before the committee to present her bill. Representative Feist, I'll move House File 745 be laid over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. Why don't you go ahead and present your bill?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I miss being on this committee, so it's good to be here. So House File 745 deals with compensatory revenue. So compensatory revenue is the part of our education budget that targets students who are underprepared to learn and not meeting academic standards. And the last I saw, it was about 8.1% of the total education budget. And Mr. Stamm can correct me, but the last numbers I saw were like $867 million or something. So it is a huge chunk of money and a huge part of our education budget and strategy. Compensatory revenue is determined or has historically been determined by using free and reduced lunch forms as a proxy. So it was not like an exact science, but we decided at some point as the legislature that we would assume that students receiving free and reduced lunch forms are underprepared to learn and not meeting academic standards. In 2022, we added to that formula and we started using receipt of certain social benefits or social services benefits like SNAP and most importantly, Medicaid direct certification. And so when we did that, the compensatory formula bumped up quite a bit. But just to emphasize again, We are always pretty imprecise in who these students are, and the free and reduced lunch forms and the Medicaid direct certification are a proxy. But we can always rethink who are these students and who do we want to generate this additional revenue. So what this bill does, I should mention that when we went to Universal Meals, we threw the formula out of whack because, number one, and I don't think we did this on purpose, but we could no longer count free and reduced lunch forms as part of how we generate compensatory revenue. But we also made it harder to collect free and reduced lunch forms because they no longer were tied to people being fed. Back in last term, set some hold harmless provisions so that schools weren't going to suddenly lose a ton of very important revenue that they relied on to serve these students. So coming back to this bill. This bill does four things. The first is that it makes it very explicitly clear that the Department of Education can indeed use free and reduced lunch forms as a proxy in addition to the other direct certification mechanisms. It also gives more flexibility for where those dollars can be spent. Last term, we increased the threshold to really try to focus those dollars that are generated at the school in which they are generated. Because of the way that the formula was thrown out of whack and some hardships that certain school districts are facing, we wanted to create some additional flexibility in the next biennium so that schools could spend those dollars across the school district as they strategically saw fit. And I'm open to more conversation on that because is Representative Bakeberg? Oh, yeah, he is here. We had a good conversation a couple of years ago, and I'm kind of convinced that we should have more conversations about whether or not we want to go even further on that provision. In addition, this bill creates a task force to look at compensatory revenue. And I think this is really important. When I first got elected in 2021, I became obsessed with compensatory revenue, and I'm glad that you're all joining me in my obsession. But it's a really large amount of money. It's a very big part of our formula. And we have a very complicated education budget, and I think it is very important that over time that we look at changing demographics and we look at how these dollars are being spent, and we do a periodic deep dive into who are the students generating this revenue? How are we spending this money? There are similar formulas across the country, and they do their compensatory aid different. Some proxies are census data. There's a lot of different ways you can figure out which students are we trying to serve with this additional funding? Or Mr. Withers would say, do we need this funding? Is that the best way to meet these needs? So I feel really passionately about the task force. I'm really excited to get all of the brilliant stakeholders in a room together to really just revisit the compensatory formula and think about how do we best serve the students of Minnesota. And lastly, we have some ... for some money because we know that the compensatory formula is out of whack. And that's not just a mechanism of the free and reduced lunch forms. That's part of it. But we just know that the way the formula is playing out over the coming biennium, that some schools across the state are just randomly losing millions of dollars out of their budget. And then some are getting a windfall. And as the Department of Education would say, there are winners and not winners. And we want to just have everyone we want stability in this formula while we're doing that additional deep dive through the task force. So for now, we have some ... and we can talk about those ... and some proposals that are out there. And let me just look to make sure I covered everything. So I think one thing I'd like to mention about the task force, something I've been trying to do for the last several years is actually come up with ideas for a new formula through conversations with stakeholders. What if we weight homeless highly mobile more? What if we look at ELL and weight that differently? What if we just do a multiplier and we do it that way? And I failed at bringing everybody together and having those conversations. And I think one of the reasons that that just doesn't work is that we don't want to make these really monumental, seismic decisions about our education budget in the context of what money we happen to have on hand that biennium. I think we want to make bigger strategic decisions that are separate and apart from the immediate, you know, makeup of the legislature and immediate, you know, state of our state budget. I think we want to think broader. And I think, yeah, I covered those things. And I just wanted to thank Representative Knutson for the conversation that we had, and that I know we're having another meeting with Tim and Christina, so I'm looking forward to working with you on this as well. And with that, I will turn it over to the testifiers.
Representative Feist, before we do that, I think I'm going to have Ms. Beckel go through the spread, the fiscal note, and then we'll have Mr. Strom go through the runs that are in your packet. Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. So the spreadsheet is for House File 745-0. Representative Feist did a great job of going through the bill, so I won't do any of that. You can see on the front page of the fiscal note, that provides you with a summary of the costs of this bill. So on the line that says biennial total, you can see that the fiscal year 26-27 total for the bill is $420.612 million. And then the total for the fiscal year 28-29 biennium is $492.121 million. And then if you'll turn to page 5, I'll go into a little more detail. This is part of the explanation from the Minnesota Department of Education. It provides a lot of great detail about how the compensatory formula, which is part of the larger general education program, is calculated. And then they just explain that there were, 310,190 students identified via the direct certification at the top there, and then 42,313 students identified via the application for educational benefits, or more commonly, the paper forms. So that is sort of an overall increase of 14% of students identified. So you can see that difference there. Then if you move down to sort of halfway down the page, they talk about the costs for the task force. So this bill does include a section that asks the Minnesota Department of Education and the Minnesota Department of Revenue to convene a task force, and the Minnesota Department of Education estimated those costs. So they said it was comprised of 13 members and then estimated the number of meetings at 16. And then estimated the number of Greater Minnesota members as well as Metro members in order to, if you turn to page 6, estimate the costs of that task force, because task force members are eligible for reimbursement on a per diem basis and also on a mileage basis. And if they have childcare costs, they're able to be reimbursed for up to $50 of that. As well, so you can see the middle box there sums up the task force costs. The first line shows the non-representative costs for the meetings, so just for the task force members who are not agency members. And then the bottom line of that middle table there shows the total task force cost, which includes some of the agency staff who are helping to facilitate the task force, so that comes in at a total of $110,000 in the fiscal year 26-27 biennium. Then that final table there just provides you with a really nice breakdown of how they calculated the compensatory revenue, which includes the primary compensatory revenue based on the formula established in 126C.10, as well as the pilot program. And then they show you how they calculate the splits, which I'm sure you love talking about. I love talking about the 90-10%. I won't go into that and bore you all, but that is the fiscal note for HF 745.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. Anybody have any questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, Mr. Strom, the other documents in our folder.
Chair, you committee members, in addition to the printouts, you got 2 weeks ago on compensatory, or last week, I don't remember. Here's one more printout for your collections on compensatory revenue. And what this form tries to do is summarize the data that's going into the formula so that you can see a couple of effects. So there's 3 years of data, those for fiscal years 24, 25, and 26, and then the impact of House File 745 on fiscal 26 as well. So those are the four scenarios being shown on the printout. Like most printouts, it's sorted in ascending district order. The pupil count that's used is the one we refer to as enrollment. That's the fall count of pupils, and that matches the number of students that are counted for free and reduced price meal eligibility or compensatory pupils. As Representative Feist explained, there's two parts of those. There's the direct count based on the state-level matching of data, and then the paper form count, the application for educational benefits. So for each year, the fall of 22 goes with fiscal 24. For each of the years, the fall count shows enrollment and then the direct and paper certification forms and the percent of paper forms by district. This is a number that committee members were talking about last time that varies a great deal from district to district. Then the revenue amount in total is shown. So if you're working across the totals line on the top, you can see for fiscal year 24, for those organizations listed on the printout, $788 million of compensatory revenue. The calculations were just the same for the fiscal year 25 year, with the exception that the count was either the greater of the fall 22 or the fall 23 counts, and you can see the total revenue there was $861 million. Then as we come over to about six columns from the end, you can see that for the base for fiscal year 26, relying only on the direct certification counts, the higher formula allowance, but only on the direct certification, and a different way of calculating the concentration, that the amount results in about $838.9 million of revenue. And then that last column shows the increase under Representative Feist's bill, House, or the fifth to last column, shows that amount in total under House File 745. And then since we had several questions come up about, well, how does this compare per enrollee, I put those columns all at the last four columns. So you can see the average district in 2024 in the fourth to last column received $917 per student. In 25, $999. On average for compensatory revenue. In 26, $960, and then under the Feist bill would be $1,198. So those give a little bit of a metric on a pupil-adjusted basis, and you can look up and down the list and see how each of your individual districts has varied over time. But the points trying to be emphasized on this printout are the amounts per enrollee, and the change from year to year for those, as well as the relationship between the direct certification count and the application for educational benefits count. So, Madam Chair, that's a quick run through the printout that's in front of members today.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And quick question, just as a reminder, does this compensatory, is this affected by the inflation indexing?
Chair Joachim, members, the formula in future years after 26 will be affected by the growth in the inflation of the basic formula allowance. It'll grow at the same rate. For fiscal year 26, there's actually a hardwired number in statute for that year under current law. So that amount is a hardwired number on the expected formula of where that was going to be for fiscal year 26. And one last point about that, there was a minimum built in the statute for fiscal year 26 and 27 as well. If the minimum isn't reached, which it wasn't in 26, it was just a little bit short, that amount was brought up to the amount you see in the sixth to last column, that $838 million amount. So the formula was hardwired into the statute for that year, the allowance, and then the minimum brought that up just a little higher than the amount printed in the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Anybody else have any questions on the runs? I know all the numbers are a lot to digest right all at once.
Can I get
Representative Feist.
If I get a copy.
Oh,
yeah. I was trying to visualize it all.
We will get you one. But members, any questions? Representative Bigberg.
I just have a question for Ms. Bechtel about the, and I'm not sure if I heard this wrong. Could you explain the legislative representation on the study group? Was that in the fiscal note? I thought I heard you say that there was a legislative representative.
Ms. Bechtel, or maybe Representative Feist might be able to talk about the composition of this task force.
Sure.
Yeah,
sorry, I don't know why I was waiting for more invitation. So it's totally nonpartisan. It's just basically the different associations and some representation by families that receive compensatory. So I don't know that I feel strongly about this, but I didn't feel that there was a need to have us necessarily involved in that task force, but I'm open to the suggestion.
Representative Bigberg.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. And I may have very well misheard what Ms. Bechtel said, so I just was wondering if there's a, did I just hear that wrong, that there was a, built into the fiscal note, there was a built-in cost for our role in the task force?
Ms. Bechtel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solveig Bechtel, House Fiscal. Representative Bakeberg, I'm very sorry if I did say legislative staff. There are costs for agency staff, there are costs for the 11 members of the task force who are eligible for the task force reimbursements, such as per diem costs, mileage, and childcare costs, if eligible. But very sorry if I use the term legislative.
Representative Baker.
You do not need to apologize. I am very convinced that it was my maybe lack of being as focused as I should have been. So thank you. I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you for the clarification, Representative Bakeberg. With that, members, any other questions on the runs? Seeing none, I think we will go to your testifiers. And the first up on the list is Zena Stenvik, and then on deck is Daniel Hunnigs, and then Adele Shuning.
Do you guys want to sit together or should I sit like this? Okay, I'll move over. Especially since this chair is like lower.
Go ahead, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. My name is Zena Stenvik. I'm the proud superintendent serving Columbia Heights Public Schools. I'm here also as a member of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts and the Region 9 representative of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators.
And my name is Daniel Honigs. I am the president of the Columbia Heights Federation of Teachers, local number 710, and I am a math teacher at Columbia Heights High School.
Thank you for being a math teacher. why don't you go ahead, Ms. Superintendent Stenvik?
We want to express our gratitude for indexing of the formula to inflation, very helpful in our planning and preparation for the next school year. We are here together today in support of House File 745, and to share the rationale for why the compensatory aid calculation needs to be remedied. We urge you to approve the hold harmless mechanism or a permanent solution to address the drastic change in compensatory aid calculation. Columbia Heights Public Schools is facing an unprecedented loss of nearly $3.7 million, which is over $1,000 per pupil, to no fault of our own. Despite our careful financial stewardship, the shift to a direct certification-only model for compensatory aid, eliminating those paper educational benefits forms, threatens our district's stability. Columbia Heights will be big losers with the new formula, not because our families are suddenly more wealthy, but simply because of the data collection method. We know that over 200 school districts are scheduled to lose this funding. In recent years, Minnesota allowed a dual model using both the paper educational benefits forms and the direct certification for calculation. Utilizing direct certification only means that many students are being missed in the calculation. At a minimum, we request that the dual system continue to be an option because our fund balance cannot absorb a $3.7 million reduction.
This is equivalent
Thank
to letting
you.
Go.
Mr. Honigs, I'm sorry, could you still state your name for the record again and proceed?
Yes, I'm Daniel Honigs, president of Columbia Heights Federation of Teachers. This is equivalent to letting go of 35 teachers, or 85% of teachers at one of our three elementary schools. After making budget cuts in seven of the last 8 years, we have no excess to trim. This funding loss will inevitably lead to larger class sizes, reduced student support, and the elimination of essential educational programs for some of the neediest students in the state. Representatives, when you see union and district in lockstep like we are today, you know this is a serious issue. Superintendent Stenvick and I have forged the bond to preserve and continue education for our students, as we have been providing it for years. For me, this is existential. Will my teachers, my members, have jobs? Will our students have the low class sizes and other services they need and deserve? The state of Minnesota must continue to allow all districts to have multiple ways to show students qualify for this compensatory revenue.
Zena Stenvick for the record. This week, our school board faced a difficult financial dilemma, weighing two challenging options: making deep budget cuts that would severely impact student support, or take a financial gamble, hoping that the legislature will adjust the compensatory aid. During this session, the urgency of the situation is very clear. We must inform our staff in the next few weeks whether they have a job next year or not. If we choose to delay the cuts, and the aid calculation remains unchanged, we will risk running out of funds to pay our staff. That means we'll be forced to borrow money and pay interest on a loan. As one board member put it, we are feeling backed into a corner, forced to consider cuts that may ultimately prove to be unnecessary.
Daniel Holmes again for the record. Representatives, it is obvious that this is not a partisan political issue, but for me, merely a bureaucratic issue. We just ask that we have multiple ways to allow our students and their families to qualify to be counted for the compensatory funding so that the Columbia Heights Public Schools can get the funds necessary to provide the best education for their students. We want to thank Representative Feist for representing our school district and thank all of you for serving on the Education Finance Committee and hearing our remarks today. Thank you.
Thank you both for coming up to testify. Next up, we have Ado Shuni, Director of Government Relations from the Department of Education. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm thankful for the opportunity here to provide some testimony on HF 745 on compensatory revenue. And I first want to emphasize the leadership. I know you mentioned that you were unsuccessful, but we are here and you've led these conversations, and I think your leadership should be noted in trying to address the advances in compensatory revenue and bringing us here and focusing on the purpose and effectiveness of this stream and in seeking stability that we also heard from our testifiers here. Next, I want to highlight the administration's support for providing a fix for compensatory revenue for fiscal 26 and, at a minimum, providing stability in the near term so that we can work collaboratively to look at the best model for this program. Inclusion of the meals forms for calculating revenue will go toward providing the stability. I also want to be clear that while meal forms are not currently in the counts for the fiscal 26 calculation, MDE has been telling LEAs that they should be still collecting meals forms for other programs that use them, like federal meal reimbursements of school meals. We appreciate the conversations with Representative Feist on the governor's proposal, which is distinct from the ongoing funding in HF 745, and we've had discussions about what the best model is going forward. But and given the current fiscal context, it's important to note that in the governor's proposal, by using the current fiscal 25 definition of compensatory pupil units, which includes meals forms, in addition to direct certification, and using the greater of the 2022 or 2024 October student counts and the calculation of the compensatory revenue for compensatory formula for fiscal 26, this bill keeps compensatory revenue more consistent and stable between fiscal 25 and 26. Comparing current law for fiscal 26 and the governor's proposal, 235 districts stand to go down and 92 up under current law for fiscal 26. Let me be clear. For comparing fiscal 26 under current law to fiscal 25, 235 districts stand to decrease in their compensatory revenue, and 92 are stand to go up. Under the governor's proposal for fiscal 26 compared to current year we're in, fiscal 25, that essentially flips. And the amount, I don't have the exact figures on me, but the amount of the biggest decrease does go down significantly between current law and what would be under the governor's proposal. So including those meals forms for fiscal 26 does have a significant positive impact for stability for our LEAs. This move toward more consistency will provide more time for districts and charters to strategically support the services funded by compensatory revenue for some of our most at-risk and underserved students. We also want to thank Representative Feist for including the governor's proposal to create a working group to analyze the compensatory formula and recommend how to improve it for future years. Changes in direct certification counts between pandemic and post-pandemic years have not been adequately evaluated at this time, and including future trends and the impact of changes to Medicaid eligibility. With one extra year of validation, MDE and working group members will be able to evaluate trends and changes in the pupil counts, allowing for better analysis and recommendations of potential changes to the compensatory revenue formula. Again, I want to thank the committee, and especially to Representative Feist, for carrying this really important proposal to provide stability and time for our districts and charters to best provide for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. And I was remiss to say we want to make sure folks kind of stick to the 2 minutes, which you did. But just as a reminder, we have Superintendent from Round Lake School District remote, Superintendent Ray Hessing. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, good afternoon, Co-Chair and Representative Creasy and members of the committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here at the request of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the Minnesota Rural Aid Association. Today, they expressed my deep concerns regarding competitive funding and their potential negative impact on students and schools across our state if this is not addressed this session. Recent legislative changes, as you know, to the compensatory funding formula create significant disparities between school districts. While some districts may see an increase in funding, others, many of which I need populations, will experience drastic reductions, such as my district.
Oh, Superintendent Hessing, he seemed to have dropped. He wasn't on video either. We'll try to, he might be back. Superintendent Hessing, I'm sorry, you dropped off there for a bit. Do you want to proceed? We are going to work on that technical difficulties and go to the next testifier. We have Matt Shaver here from AdAllies. Please state your name for the record and proceed. I'll give you a minute to settle in.
Chair Uakim, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 745. My name is Matt Shaver. I'm the Senior Policy Director at AdAllies. I want to thank Representative Feist for authoring this bill and for years of stewardship of this enormously important way Minnesota provides additional resources for students in poverty. Happy Compensatory Revenue Day, everyone. It's an organizational priority for AdAllies to fairly fund schools based on student need. In fact, I just finished serving on a statewide task force convened by MDE on improving the way Minnesota funds students. The outcome of that task force published an 80-page report filled with recommendations, best practices, and research. A letter is in your packet from some of those members. Compensatory revenue came up quite a bit in that task force as well. Compensatory revenue is our state's best lever for coordinating resources to schools serving lots of students with high needs, and it's imperative we get it right. The current formula honors the reality that two schools with the same overall enrollment but different student poverty levels have different resource needs. And at the same time, there are major issues with how we count kids for the purpose of generating compensatory dollars, how the formula treats those students, and what districts can do with those funds. For example, this formula that exists to give schools additional resources to support students in poverty somehow both penalizes schools for serving too many students in poverty and penalizes schools for serving kids not quite in poverty enough. And at times, these dollars have also been allowed to be moved away from the very students who generated those dollars. This building allocation amount has danced around between 100% to 95% to 80% to 50% over the decades. And in 2023, the legislature set that requirement that at least 80% of the funds generated by the students in a building go to the education of the students who generated it. Last week, this committee looked at the 2020 OLA report on compensatory revenue. Back when districts had the flexibility to move 50% of the dollars, OLA surveyed 132 superintendents for its report. Only 27 of those districts reported using any funds at sites other than where they were generated. And of those 27 districts that reported using funds at other sites, 82% reported moving less than 20% of those dollars. So we want to keep these protections in place because high-poverty schools in a district may end up subsidizing low-poverty schools in the same district, which can kneecap the impact of these dollars. Compensatory revenue exists to provide additional funding based on the accumulation of student need within a building, not within a district, so the funds ought to be spent that way. So finally, the forms. We support adding the forms back to the count of students who generate compensatory revenue. For now, doing this will cast the widest possible net to find students who should be generating compensatory dollars. Big picture, we need to decide as a state what the goal of this money is. Who should generate these extra dollars, how to count them, what schools can do with the money, how to know whether the money is making an impact on the target student groups. Rep Weiss has patiently, diligently led many, many informal discussions on building a better formula, but time and again, the consensus path has been to just send more money through a busted formula. Kids deserve more than Band-Aids and the status quo. House File 745 deals with the immediate term issue while getting a task force to keep people at the table till we build something better. I want to thank you all for your service to your state.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. We've got one more testifier, and then we'll go to member questions. We have two more testifiers. Superintendent Hessing, welcome back.
I don't know what happened there. I apologize for that. As I was stating before, the unpredictable shifts in the funding levels make it difficult for districts to plan and sustain critical programs that directly support our most vulnerable students. My district alone stands to lose $329,000, which for some doesn't sound like a lot. When you have a district of about 550 students, that's a big part of our budget, especially when 75% of our students are Hispanic, and we have a 73% free reduced lunch count, and 60% of our students receive EL service. The district next to us that we share students with, Worthington, they're predicted to lose $2.7 million. So the two districts alone where we share families and students, $1 million is going to be lost. That's a lot of money coming away from the needs our students have. For districts facing funding cuts, these reductions could result in larger class sizes, as you know, fewer intervention programs, and diminished resources for academic support services. The students who rely most on compensatory funding, those in poverty.
We'll work on that technical, and maybe we'll have Superintendent Hessing submit written testimony, and we'll make sure we get that in member packets. He's back again. Superintendent Hessing, you keep dropping out, so I'm hoping that you could just submit written testimony to the members. That would be great, or to our CA.
Thank you.
Last testifier we have is Chris Campa, Director of Finance and Operations at Cambridge Isanti School District. Thank you, Director. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Campa, and I am the Director of Finance and Operations for Cambridge Isanti Schools. Really, thank you for the time today. I did have some prepared remarks, but a lot of my other testifiers really covered this, and I think that a lot of us get the importance of the compensatory revenue, and really just want to thank everyone for everything that you do for education, because, you know, as a finance director, I can really see the impact that it goes, and all of the different revenue and funding streams that we receive are all super important. It's difficult to say some are more important than others, but when I look at it, compensatory revenue does, I think, go to the top, because student needs are higher now than what they ever have been before. And this goes to addressing those student needs and addressing those students that, have some of the largest difficulties that they're facing, and allow school districts to provide those different supports supports for them. A while back, I was really excited to get to not have to rely on the paper forms for calculating compensatory revenue because of the logistical burdens and administrative burdens of managing that. But we do now see that there is a financial impact. Our school district's not one of the biggest losers in this. You know, we are losing some revenue, and that will hurt. But we know that other districts are losing hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars, and that just hurts a lot more. So just really impact about the disparity across the system on this. And it comes at a time where we're facing a very critical funding gap in school districts. We know that the majority of school districts are looking at staffing reductions for next year, and that's hard for kids. Compensatory revenue is one of those areas that when funding drops and the programs and staff that serve our most vulnerable students, the ones who need the most amount of support, are often the first to be affected. And many of these programs are mandated, but with school districts without adequate funding are left with no choice but to look at these essential services. So we just really ask that you protect our compensatory revenue by any means possible. Hold harmless would be great, but just it, as we look into just how the students are calculated to ensure that this critical funding source is maintained. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Director Campa. I hope I said that right. Thank you. With that, members, I think we'll go to questions at the table. And at first, I have Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question and then just a comment, but I'll ask my question first. Representative Feister, oh, there you are, okay. Is there any, I know there's direction in here to have a working group to determine how the money is best distributed and that type of thing, but is there a working group that would address whether compensatory revenue funding is actually effective? And that examines that part of it.
Representative Feist. Yes, thank you for the question. That definitely is what I would like to see them do. I'm just looking at the way we wrote it. So determine whether compensatory revenue, it's a concentration formula. Evaluate the best uses. I guess so number 7 at line 4.15 is evaluate the best uses of compensatory, but your question is should we actually have one that's just like, is compensatory the best way to achieve the goals that we've established?
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's my question.
Representative Feist. That definitely is something I want them to do. I'm looking at the exact way that we phrased it. Like a lot of it is like, who are the students generating this revenue? Like, who do we want to generate this revenue? But I can look through this and talk with you some more because I would be very happy to have that be an additional directive where we just say, like, is compensatory revenue a mechanism that we think meets the needs of students in Minnesota? Because I do think that's part of what we're trying to get at here.
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Feist. I would love to work with you on that and our team here. And I do believe that needs to be addressed as is this funding, has it been effective? Because we've had decades of compensatory revenue funding. And first, I want to preface all this and tell our schools, I know you're hurting right now financially. That's not what I'm getting at here. There were tons of mandates that were poured upon our schools over the last 2 years. They're hurting right now. I get that. But at the same time, and I know your heart's with this too, Representative Feist, we need to determine if this funding is effective. And if we can get a working group in on this, I don't believe it should be the same group that's determining, that receives the funding or is benefiting from it, because it really should be determined by some kind of an outside group that's able to examine it without bias. Because I know our schools are counting on this funding to fill gaps, and not necessarily for what it's intended for. I'll just give some examples here of how much funding. Now, this has been going on for many, many years. we have, I think the statewide average is something like $985 per pupil. Minneapolis receives $1,711 per pupil. St. Paul, $2,300 per pupil. Faribault schools, $2,400 per pupil. There is a school in our state, and I won't say where, just to leave it so that we don't disparage any school. And it's they receive $4,000 per pupil, but they only have a 12% proficiency in reading. And this is, we could look at this on and on. The data is showing that this funding is not effective for what it's intended for, to improve things like attendance, reading, math, science proficiency, graduation rates, that kind of thing. So we really need to start analyzing is how we're funding things. Is it effective? We look at our nonprofit groups, which I've been, you know, trying to figure out ways to hold them accountable for results. But as legislators, we need to be accountable for what we're funding too. And just ask the question without any partisan jabs to say, is it working? Because if it's not working, we need to change our trajectory and change what we're doing. We can't just pour more money in. And I get it. The schools are hurting now. So I'm passionate about this. I think you are too, Representative Feist. Let's start determining, is it really working, instead of just deciding, well, how should we divide this out so it's fair? I just the same want to ask, is it effective? So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
Sorry.
You, Representative Bennett. Representative Feist, follow-up.
Yeah, I had a couple of follow-up points. So last term, we did implement a lot of the recommendations on the policy side from the OLA. Specifically, we narrowed the acceptable uses of compensatory dollars, and then we also changed the mechanism for reporting because it was kind of like the OLA made the point that it's kind of impossible what we were asking schools to explain in terms of the direct impact. So I actually have no idea how that's playing out, and the school stakeholders could let us know perhaps, but I'm curious to see what we have learned, and maybe it's too soon, from changing that sort of reporting mechanism from schools back to us. And then also I just wanted to mention the task force, the goal was to create like a real diversity, geographic diversity, like diversity of expertise. And they would come back to us with recommendations, but then they wouldn't be the decision makers, like we would be the decision makers.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Yeah, sometimes we actually have to tell districts to do things and ask them for reports. So thank you for doing that policy work last year. We have Representative Ingham. And then I have Representative Lawrence. And then if anybody else wants to get on the list, please let me know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Feist. I do think that you're coming at this from a good perspective and a willingness to want to make a fix and find a solution. But I know that I'm new to this committee. I have a lot that I have yet to learn. But it seems to me, and please, this is kind of an open-ended question for anybody on the committee, but it seems like we have an issue that we created via the free meals program with the paperwork issues. And then to address that manufactured problem, we're comprising a task force of governor appointees and NGO members, and the task force doesn't actually have the duty of diving into what the issue is when it comes to educational outcomes not always being improved by compensatory revenue as it currently works. First off, am I getting that right? Or am I way off base? It's open-ended, but it seems like we're starting from the false assumption that the system is currently working effectively and efficiently. Is that something that you could address, Representative Feist?
Representative Feist.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that. So I have been really focused on compensatory revenue since before universal meals was discussed and enacted. So I think that we have had issues like Representative Bennett really highlighted for a long time. And so, you know, the way that universal meals impacted the formula was just a manifestation of those larger issues with the formula. That we, you know, so I would say that universal meals definitely had an impact on using free and reduced lunch forms as a proxy, but that is not the cause. It's just one more manifestation of the larger problem with a broken formula.
Representative Ingen, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate you saying that. We did try to address this problem, I believe, in 2023. It kind of fell on deaf ears, but I just would like us to operate from an understanding that maybe sometimes we're creating the problems which then we seek to fix, rather than starting from a position of saying, hey, is what we're doing working? We always just kind of engage in this catch-22 of funding things that are broken. So I just hope that we take that into consideration if this bill ever does come to the floor and somehow get 68 votes. Thank you.
Representative Feist, follow-up.
I just agree with you.
Okay. Thank you. That's Thanks. Kind of what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, thank you. Just quick question. You've got the task force set out here. What is your reasoning for not including any members from the Senate or the House in the task force? If you could just comment on that, please.
Okay. Representative Feist. Yeah, thank you. You know, I didn't feel that we were necessary. Like, and I'm open, like I was saying to Representative Bayford, I don't feel like super strongly about this, but, you know, we all come to this space representing our constituents with our very, you know, diverse backgrounds and areas of expertise. And when I was thinking about who do we want to be on this task force to talk about these really, really like granular practical questions in a lot of ways, like, because when we talk about like what is the best proxy, the question is about, like the larger question, like who do we want to generate this revenue? Then like how are we identifying those students? So just to give you one really random example, one of the things that experts say is that the educational level of a parent is one of the best indicators for whether that student is going to struggle in school. But then the question to the education stakeholders is, how hard is it to gather that information in a systematic, verifiable way? And so it might be the most accurate, but is it like a totally impractical thing for us to put on them? And so I feel like the people on this list, which is, I'm very open to input, and you know, these are the people who I thought would bring the necessary expertise and practical hands-on understanding of what it all would mean for, like, students on the ground. That's who is on this list. But if other people feel like legislators need to be on, I'm open to it. Like, I'm on a really cool task force around guardianship, and I'd like to think I bring something to it. But yeah, I'm open to it.
Representative Lawrence, any quick follow-up?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Feist. I would encourage, being one that got to sit on the task force for truancy and absenteeism, mm-hmm. I think there's a benefit for having members from our House as well as the Senate sit on task force like this and get a firsthand view of what's being discussed in the direction it's going. So I assume there might be a couple others that may agree. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Johnson. We're going to try to finish this by 2:05, 2:10. So if questions and answers could go a little bit faster, that'd be great. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. So this is kind of to the point of Representative Bennett's questions, too. We've talked a lot about flexibility, not just today in this type of funding, but flexibility in a lot of the different funding that our school districts get. And I don't know if anybody from any of the administration side, I don't expect you would have an answer to this, but what safeguards will be put in place to ensure that this aid is that we're designating to help certain groups is actually getting where it needs to get and is not flexibly moved out?
Representative Feist.
Well, the school budgets, I'm going to answer, and then really smart people can make technical corrections to whatever I'm about to say. But, like, we know how schools are spending their money, and we say in statute what the compensatory revenue can be spent on. I think my larger concern is that we aren't being precise and targeted in how those dollars are spent. But we technically do have access to that information about how those dollars are being spent. And we did narrow the acceptable uses of compensatory aid last term.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. Just okay. One quick follow-up. Just a little concern about the use of flexibility when it comes to some of these things. And I know, like, when you responded to Representative Bennett, too, you talked about, like, narrowing the scope. But I guess my concern would be that flexibility reopens that scope. Is there safeguards to make sure that that scope is truly kept narrow and hitting where it needs to hit?
Representative Feist, quickly.
Yes, so I think you're referring to the additional flexibility that we built in for the next biennium. And to clarify, that's flexibility on where those dollars will be spent. It is not flexibility on how those dollars will be spent.
Perfect.
Got it. Thank you. I have got Rehrauer, Sensenmura, Bonner, Bakeberg, and then closing from Kreisha. So if folks would like to drop off, that would be great. Representative Rehrauer, quickly, please.
I'll try to be quickly. So Representative Feist, the bill does have the specific stakeholders listed as part of that task force. They're required to be there with the bill. Is there anything that would prevent a legislative representative from joining the task force if they wanted to?
Representative Feist.
You know, I think that we'd always be welcome. I know on the task force I'm on, a member of the public comes and has, you know, is participating. So we could okay. Just come and hang out if we wanted to.
I think that's an option, and it sounds like you're also open to adding that if that was a necessity. The other thing I wanted to point out, so the Universal Meal Program was a separate bill from the bills who had the aim of limiting the impact of the universal meals change. And I think, I wasn't here, but I think it had to do with the fear that families wouldn't fill out that form. If now they are getting the universal meal, why would they fill out the free and reduced price lunch form? So the whole purpose was to try to make sure there wasn't a negative impact on districts. But with, you know, more knowledge comes more. So what I'm hearing is that this bill will be work towards both a short-term and a long-term fix, and I think this is the route to go because we're trying to make sure there's no harm in the short term and then bring everybody together in the long term and figure out what is the best thing we do with compensatory revenue, and I think this task force is a great way to do that. So I urge support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rehrauer. Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just be quick with my comments. So I just want to make it clear. There was a problem where kids were being hungry at school, and so we decided to solve that problem with universal free school meals. There was also a problem where with the forms, we were leaving families who should be able to get additional services for their students behind, so we went to direct certification. Now we are trying to solve a problem where there is instability for our schools at a time where there is incredible instability for them. They're coming off of 4 years of federal funding for the pandemic that is drying up, that is going away, even though we know the issues and problems from the pandemic are still there. We're at a time of extreme uncertainty from the federal government. And so we are trying to give schools some bit of certainty while we look towards the bigger issue. And I think, you know, a lot of times we talk about this money as, you know, generating revenue. And I know that for the purposes of education finance, like that is the way to look at it. But that really masks what these dollars are for. It's not about generating the revenue. It's about who needs the extra support and how do we make sure that our funding formula is matching that. So as someone who's been a part of this committee for a couple of years, just wanted to set the record straight on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. Very well spoken. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist, for this bill. So I had a couple interesting questions, and forgive me because I'm a little new to this. But I assume that the way in which we're determining eligibility is determined based on some data around MA, SNAP, and TANF. I assume that data is coming from the agencies. Is that accurate?
Representative Feist.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. So one of the things I was going to say is that I'm curious about what the barriers are that are causing students to fall between the cracks and not apply for benefits. I'm not sure if most folks in the room are aware, but MNIT has been working on sort of a one front door application to allow folks to kind of come in and determine what services they might be available and make sure that where the services are going where they need to. I don't know what the prevalence of the kids who are falling through the cracks are, where we're still requiring a paper form, or why those kids aren't being captured, and maybe you can speak to that. But I do wonder also if part of that is making sure that we're capturing those students and we're getting the data and we're accurately having the right criteria on how to assess which students should be getting this aid. I do wonder if MNIT shouldn't have some sort of role here to help understand who are those students we're trying to capture and how do we make sure that our systems that are giving you the data to determine the formula how they could work more effectively and more efficiently to make sure that we're actually getting more accurate counts and that we're not having to duplicate effort by filling out paper forms.
Representative Bonner, was that a just comment or question or? Or both? Mm-hmm. Representative Feist, follow up?
Yeah, I mean, that might be part of it. Like, we know that some people were covered under the pandemic rules where they didn't have to extend their eligibility and they fell off when they had to complete more paperwork to show they were eligible. And then there are just some low-income people who are not eligible for certain benefits but who need and deserve this additional support in our schools. So it's not just an issue of, like, IT communication. But that might be, like, a piece of it.
Thank you, Representative Feist. With that, I think I'll go to Representative Bakeberg and then closing from Chair Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good conversation. Representative Feist, thank you for your work on this. It's obviously a really important issue for our schools that they're facing right now. And just appreciate how you work collaboratively on it. I have a question for the department, and it really is more getting into Representative Bennett's. Like, are we effectively using the dollars? That's kind of what I'm trying to get at with this. And how we're spending money, is it working? Because we all know, and we heard from our testifiers, that schools across the state are struggling right now, even prior to the compensatory issue, but just with a number of budgetary issues. So, Mr. Uni, is the department tracking the effectiveness, or is there a way that the department is tracking a district spends X number of dollars on compensatory revenue and this is their result? Like Representative Bennett shared multiple examples of districts didn't go in, or schools. So is the department tracking the dollars being spent and then correlating that to academic success?
Mr. Uni, please state your name for the record again and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Adosh, I'm the Director of Government Relations, been the Department of Education. That's a question I don't know if I have all the details to in terms of the effectiveness analysis. I know that for expenditures under a range of aid flows, including compensatory revenue, we have UFARS codes. So what are the uses that they were applied for under the allowable uses, and then we get a code, and so we say it was used for A through H. I can't remember what the allowable uses are there. If they are tied to effectiveness, I do believe that we receive, we're supposed to receive plans from LEAs in terms of where they allocate their fundings and what type of programs they do, but in terms of the outcomes and effectiveness tied to how the compensatory aid is spent that the districts apply to, like an effectiveness report, I would have to go back and see with the school finance team if there's anything that approximates to that. I just don't have that information right now. So that's something that I can go back and check with the team on.
Representative Bakeberg, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think, so just to be very clear, there are going to be multiple factors into whether or not a student is successful. So I don't think there's going to be a direct correlation, but we should be able to, for the amount of money that we're talking about here that we're spending, we should be able to say this school site spends X number of dollars on compensatory revenue and they are seeing X percentage of success on our standardized assessments, or they are being successful at this rate. I understand there's factors into that, but if we're going to have a task force to examine, we should start with the effectiveness of, is this actually accomplishing what we want to accomplish? And then if we can identify specific schools that are finding success, then we should highlight those schools and use those as opportunities to highlight successes so we're working smarter and we're not just spending money and reinforcing a problem that is not changing. And at the end of the day, these are our most at-risk kids. Think about that. Our most at-risk kids are getting this funding, and we don't have an answer on whether or not we can track whether or not it's working.
Mr. Uni, I saw you raise your hand. Representative Feist.
Yeah, so we And maybe Mr. Strom can remind me specifically, but so the one of the recommendations that the OLA had was that we used to have in law that schools had to report on the impact, and the OLA observed, and what Mr. Uni and I were just talking about on the side, is that that's kind of impossible to show, like, we spent this dollar on additional supports in the classroom or smaller sizes, and that had a direct impact on, like, these students, like, test scores. So I think, you know, it's a really, like, I think you're right, like, and I think it's important, which is why I'm so obsessed with the compensatory formula, is that we do want to understand, like, why are we spending this money and what is the impact? But at the same time, you know, I work a lot around our juvenile justice funding and, you know, money that we're spending through our public safety budget, through our children, youth, and families budget around, like, juvenile justice and at-risk kids. Like, that also has a direct impact on, like, truancy and, you know, academic attainment. So, you know, this is the best committee. I shouldn't say that. I'm on three other committees that I love too. But, like, this is a great committee because it's so complicated and this work is so important. And I don't think there are, like, answers. But sorry, I'm just going long. Yeah. I'm thinking philosophical thoughts.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And I think we'll move to the closing in a second. But that was one of the things the OLA report tried to tackle as well, because it was hard to quantify the results of it.
Yeah.
And I know the task force will be looking at that as well. Closing to Chair Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a lot of notes. So first of all, let me start this. Thank you, Representative Feist. Many people, you've dug into this deep into the pool. Many of us have been in there already without life jackets. Going all the way back to my earliest days, 2012, this started in 1969, the OLA. I mean, you know all the benchmarks. And so we'll start there, but thank you, because this is a behemoth of a challenge. Let me address the task force first and the misgivings I have about the task force. And the reason I think the task force, I'm not sure that any task force can do this, and I'm not sure the right mechanism to get there, because the testifier, Mr. Shaver, said, I mean, we have a broken system. Let's just start there. This is broken. This does not anymore meet the needs of when 1969 and the $30 per student was put together, because we have squished and pushed and made this thing malleable all over the years. So we have a system that, and the OLA report calls this out, there's no way to track the effects of this. Zero, academically. So we'll start there. So I look at the task force, and I appreciate going through that, but the stakeholders in the task force here, and they have different goals than what compensatory was set up to do, and that was academic achievement. This is a group, partisans, not the right word, but political is. This is a group of political interests, and I'm not saying that negatively, but they're fighting over limited resources, and they're all going to stake out their grounds, and that's what they do. And I mean, they're in this room a lot. I get that. That's why I'm saying I don't think they can get us the result. The other thing is, I don't think when we look at this, can we defend any program, or can we, I mean, every program we've done has its merits. Universal school lunch, we know why that was, but the mechanism of that changed other mechanisms, which changed other mechanisms. It's just what happened. I can make the case that many of these students were, you know, in the OLA report calls it out, it was to help certain students. We've tried to help those students multiple times with multiple programs, with multiple mechanisms, and we don't know the results. And hunger was one of those, and rightfully so. But we keep assuming, and if you look at Mr. Strom's report, which is fantastic, by the way, table one, the trend of this was, starting in at the beginning of his, compensatory was moving up with free and reduced, and then it was coming back down. We look at this and goes in dollars. My question is, no, isn't that families that are improving? We don't know, because the purpose of this was to get families to improve. So why are we leaving out the variable that some families have moved out of this need? And not, but the schools, I get where they're at. They're going to look at this and say, at the bottom of my spreadsheet, the number changed. But what about the families that changed? Because that's really what we're trying to get to. So when we look at that, Representative Feist, you called this out with your areas of the justice. Economic status is the one of a very many variables. There is chronic inebriation. There is whether or not you move through the child protection system. There is, do you have a family member that was incarcerated? And you can go on and on and on. And everybody, again, We're trying to deal with a certain group of students, and we're attacking those students from different angles. But the reality is, and I'll leave special ed aside, we cannot tell, give me two students, what their educational needs are right now based on all of these variables. When I was working in the child protection side, one of the biggest variables that we knew that a child might end up in the child protection system was there only one parent on a birth certificate? In fact, if there was only a mother listed, there was a huge, huge percentage chance that child was going to need things down the road. So, bringing this all back here, and there's a lot of things. We have this group that's going to be very politically attuned to this because they're looking to protect how the dollars will flow through the budgets. And then we as legislators, it's all like walking through an apple orchard. We start at home. Our superintendent talks to us about it, gives you an apple and gives you an anecdote. They don't give you a data point. They give you an anecdote. Hey, this is what's happening. And then I go to another school district, and they give me an apple, which is an anecdote. Pretty soon I have a basket of anecdotes, but I don't have any data. Mm-hmm. And then we're trying to make policy off of that. Representative Johnson, to your point, and I'm not disagreeing, I'm just calling this out, but you talk about flexibility versus results. Do we want results or do we want flexibility? Because we've tried both, and the reality was this program started off with flexibility. We've shrunk that flexibility. In fact, now school boards have less than 50% approval on what they can do with these dollars, and the results haven't gone up. So I'm not arguing one way or the other. I'm just saying I would say the results are way more important than whether or not you had the flexibility to get there. If you were creative as a school district and you could get to it, tell us how so we can turn that to a best practice versus turn it into a state law. So we have that. And then we have the anomaly. I look at this. Part of me goes, maybe we just roll the dice and let this go for another biennium. Because if you look at the trend in this committee, coming from 2021 to 2022, with the influx of dollars and the inflator that was in there, and that was all passed. Again, I'm not here to defend or, let's just talk about that for what it is. That was a good influx of money. That brought this up. So if I look at this and for the school districts, you're getting more money than in 2021 because of that. But you're getting less than when this changed, and you're looking at those two data points. Again, you're looking at a basket of anecdotes versus a basket of data. So I look at this and go, okay, is this an anomaly, and is it going to sort itself out, and then which families are going to drop off over time? And the real question I look at is, how are we getting to a student to determine their exact needs? And that's almost impossible. Representative Feist, you had mentioned the education of the parents could be a big factor. I don't disagree with that, but I've also found out, going through the child protection, that it's resiliency, that you can give me two students that go through very difficult times, the one student that can handle resiliency and come back will succeed, and the one that cannot, that's usually a better predictor. So I look at this and I say, all right, I don't know how we get there based on this. Do we let this go for 2 years and let it come out and look at the families? And really, to Mr. Shaver's point, break the system, start over, and identify those students, because you've got we have a $420 million fiscal note on a $486 million surplus. That doesn't work. So I don't know how we get there mathematically. So we'll continue to have talks about this and try to piece this together. But I think it's really going to be about going back almost to the 1969 question of why are we building this funding? Because we have all English Learner Aid. We have all truancy. We're doing all these other things to get to certain students, and we can't sort out what we've actually got right. We have consolidations of schools and all this. And then I come to the other side of the spectrum where we're not addressing is we're saying, as Representative Bakeford said, these are very at-risk students. So is our goal to just move at-risk students, or is our goal to move every student to their top potential? Because if so, we don't have any money on the gifted and talented side as well to hit the other side of the spectrum. So we have created through the many, many years in this committee of not partisan but political territories that have made this into a huge, huge mess. And yes, now that we're starting to look at the shortening of resources, this is amplifying what's coming down the road. This is not the end of our discussions. If we hold this formula harmless, it's only going to make it worse in the outlying years as we look at the tails. So Those are my closing comments. I think we're going to have to get way more aggressive and we're going to have to put everything on the table if we're going to try to get to a solution on this. I appreciate you for getting us to this point. Let's keep pushing up against the waterfall, and eventually that salmon will make it upriver.
Thank you, Chair Carisha. I do appreciate your comments. Representative Feist, want to close us up, and then we'll lay this on the table so we can have more scintillating discussions because we need to.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. Like I said, I've been obsessed with compensatory revenue for a while, so welcome to my world. I look forward to continuing this conversation. I had just three quick points I wanted to make. Huge fluctuations in school budgets are not good. I have a small business, and if, you know, one year to the next, I all of a sudden found out that I was going to lose, like, just a huge amount of revenue and had to lay off people, like, I would feel awful about that. And we definitely, you know, don't want that to happen in our schools. So I think that it is essential that we do something this year to address that immediate, urgent need. Second, I just wanted to emphasize that the task force should not be making decisions for us. Like, we are the legislature. We should make the decisions. My vision for this task force is just really getting all the experts together and giving them a really specific task. But giving them a really specific list of things that we want them to really grapple with and then give us their expert opinion on. But at the end of the day, then we all come together and make informed decisions based on their, you know, just on the ground expertise. And then lastly, I just wanted to end with something that Mr. Strom told me when I was first elected. If I went back to, like, one of the first text exchanges we ever had in one of the first Education Finance Committee committees that I ever sat in, and I texted him, and I was like, is it a bad thing how complicated this is? And he told me no, that it's complicated because we are being specific and targeted in how we think about our education budget. And I agree. Like, I appreciate how complex this education budget is, because what we are trying to do is complex. It's not, you know, kids are not widgets. We can't just be like money in, product out. Like, this is really complicated. And it is for that reason that we really need to dig into the compensatory revenue formula for all the reasons that we've talked about today, to really understand what are we trying to do here? How do we make sure that every kid in Minnesota is, you know, at grade level and, you know, ready to learn and thriving. So that's our mission, and this is a big part of it. And I'm really grateful for the conversation and look forward to continuing to work with all of you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. I'll renew my motion that House File 7045 be laid over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. With that, we have Representative Ream with House File 2210. Welcome to your committee. While you get settled to move things along, I'll move House File 2210 before the committee today with also the intention of laying this over for a possible education bill. And I know you have a DE1 to get the bill in the shape you'd like it in so that we could have a fuller discussion. So why don't we just put the DE1 on first? Are there any questions? Seeing none, with that, all those in favor say aye. All those opposed say no. The DE1 is adopted. Representative Ream, why don't you go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. I'll be very brief with my comments so we have time for the testifiers here. But I want to bring up three points about HF2210, bringing up the past, what's happening right now, and what our plans are for the future with this bill. So in 2023, the legislature authorized unemployment insurance for hourly school employees for the summer term, beginning with the summer of 2023. The legislature created an account in the special revenue fund to reimburse school districts for their unemployment costs. The 2023 legislature appropriated $135 million for this purpose. These funds covered the amounts necessary for hourly workers claiming unemployment insurance during the 2023 and 2024 summer terms and will partially cover the costs for the summer term of 2025. This bill, House File 2022-10, appropriates $30 million in fiscal year 2026 to cover the estimated remaining costs for the summer of 2025 and $70 million in fiscal year 2027 for the estimated cost for the summer of 2026. For special education paraprofessionals, payment of direct unemployment aid to school districts reduces the cost to the state's special education base budget since these amounts are funded directly. Point three, this bill also authorizes school districts to include summer term worker unemployment costs in their local unemployment insurance levy authority for fiscal years 2028 and later. And with that, if we could bring forward the testifiers, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Ream. First on the list, we have Ann Krampitz, behavioral interventionist from Owatonna. She is on remote, and this is a good time for me to remind testifiers to please limit your comments to 2 minutes. With that, Ann Krampitz, do you want to state your name for the record and proceed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Krampitz, and I'm an ESP in Owatonna Public Schools. I want to thank the legislators for passing the unemployment insurance bill for hourly school workers so we are treated the same as other specialized seasonal workers in Minnesota. I'm here to stress the need for a permanent funding solution for this benefit. I am a widowed para that has spent 33 years doing this job that I truly love. It is getting harder and harder to stay in this position because wages make it impossible to survive. But the unemployment benefit have made that easier. Every year when the district offers me summer employment, I take it. The employment, however, is only for 2 weeks. I am a behavioral interventionist and deal with heartbreaking stories on a daily basis and work hard to alleviate and work through the trauma kids are experiencing in this difficult world. The need for a mental health break from this job is so important. The importance of knowing that we can rest easy instead of begging outside employers who do not want to hire a temporary staffer over the summer is a huge relief. Please make sure to continue to support this much needed opportunity for all support staff to continue to provide structure and consistency to our most needy population by funding the unemployment insurance benefit. Having access to this benefit will mean myself and my coworkers will be back in the fall to fill these critical roles supporting our students. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your work in our schools. Next up, we have Kristen Scott, and then on deck is Valerie Dozlin. You can both come up at the same time if you'd like. When you get settled, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, my name is Kristen Scott and I'm a special education paraprofessional in the Elk River School District. I'm very grateful for the unemployment insurance for hourly workers. Allowing the program to expire will put the functioning of our schools in jeopardy. Bus drivers, nutritional staff, custodians, clerical staff, and paraprofessionals like me are the people who make our schools function. We make sure your precious babies make it to school safely, are nourished and cared for while they learn, and are returned home safely to you day after day. This is not glamorous work, but it is essential, and we show up to do it every day because your children are important to us. As paraprofessionals, there are a multitude of duties and positions we may be asked to fill. We care for your children. We learn what your children are learning, and we get to know your child and how they learn so that we can help them be successful in their education. The experience we gain each year and the relationships we build are invaluable in doing what we do. I do not make a great deal of money doing this important and essential work. My income, including a summer job and collecting unemployment, barely meets the cost of living for the counties my school district serves. I receive my first paycheck of the school year on October 5th after working for an entire month. The last paycheck I received the year before is June 20th. We have limited opportunities for summer school assignments, and it's difficult to find short-term full-time work. The unemployment benefits I access in the summer help me bridge the gap and assist me and many other hourly school workers in providing for our families. It also allows us to continue to come back each year to do the important job of helping all of our children thrive. Without unemployment benefits, many of us are forced to find alternative work, which leads to many not returning the following school year. Retaining well-trained paraprofessionals is essential to having schools that work for our children. If you want great outcomes for our kids, you need to ensure support for the people who are teaching them, feeding them, and caring for them every day. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you today.
Thank you, and thank you for your work in our schools. Go ahead, after Valerie Dozlin, we have Sammy Rahib from MDE.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dulzon. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. When the bill to extend unemployment insurance to summer term employees advanced in 2023, we advocated then that it was critical the state provide funding to cover these costs. Absent funding from the state, the cost would have to come out of a school district's general fund where it would compete with classroom funding and programming for students. While we advocated for a permanent funding stream then, we were appreciative that one-time funding was provided. Although our preference is to have state aid cover these costs on an ongoing basis, we recognize that is a significant challenge given the current fiscal environment. However, it is important that our school districts have a predictable funding stream to cover these costs. Absent ongoing state aid, we appreciate the funding available through, under current law, the special ed formula and the unemployment levy proposed in this bill. As you all know, the levy presents challenges, particularly for school districts with low property wealth. But given the reality of the times, we want to ensure that at least a permanent and predictable funding stream is in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie Dulzon and Sammy Rahib, and then Denise T. Trick on deck. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sammy Rajab, Assistant Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief testimony on House File 2210 today. I first want to communicate MDE's general support for providing an additional unemployment insurance aid for hourly workers. By adding additional one-time funds to the aid, we can continue to provide stability to districts across our state and allow dedicated hourly school staff who provide essential services to the schools and students to continue accessing this benefit. Similarly to House File 2210, the governor has included a provision in his bill for a one-time appropriation of $30 million in the general fund for fiscal year 2026 for unemployment insurance aid. This represents the amount needed to add to the projected carryover from the end of this fiscal year to fiscal year 2026 to cover total expected costs of up to approximately $70 million of estimated 2026 total summer term costs that may be submitted. In fiscal year 2024, we saw a projected use of $44 million in the UI aid and are projected to spend $58 million in fiscal year 2025 based on feedback from LEAs. This aid is being utilized, and our hourly school workers deserve this benefit other hourly workers across the state have access to. Thank you, Representative Ream, for bringing forward this proposal, and I look forward to our continued collaboration on this as we move forward this year.
Thank you, Sammy Rajab. Thank you. Sorry about pronouncing your name wrong. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, a statewide advocate for public education. We represent all 331 school districts. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to House File 2210 as amended. When the legislature established the summer unemployment insurance for hourly workers in 2023, it also created the special revenue fund to reimburse districts for these costs, an essential safeguard to prevent added financial strain on school districts' general funds or the local property taxpayers. We were encouraged when the legislature provided $135 million to support this new policy change, recognizing that schools would face significant costs and they would probably continue to increase throughout the years. Now, with the state appropriations running out this summer and the levy authority now being proposed under this bill, the local school boards will be asked to shift the rising costs onto local property taxpayers. The impact of this shift will not be felt equally. While wealthier school districts may absorb the cost with little disruption, property poor communities will struggle, especially those unable to pass referendums, jeopardizing future funding measures in the future. For those school districts that are reluctant to increase property taxes, the only alternative is to divert funds from the district's general fund at a time when many school districts are already making very difficult cuts to staff and programs. This puts our local boards in a very difficult position. Do they take money out of the general fund, or do they raise property taxes for a program that they did not request? MSBA asked the legislature to maintain its commitment to funding these costs at the state level, rather than shifting another financial burden onto school districts or local property taxpayers. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Denise Dietrich. Then I have Noel Schmidt, and Kat Briggs. If you both want to come up, you're our last two testifiers. Noel Schmidt, please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Noel Schmidt, and I am the superintendent of schools for Rock Ridge up on the Iron Range. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, you got to go see Rock Ridge. It's unbelievable. Everybody who's gone through there has gone, wow, it's like nothing you've ever seen before. And because we're doing Career Academy, but that's not why I'm here. Now, everything I'm about to say is I'm not representing an organization. I'm here representing myself and other people like me out there. I'm just a regular guy trying to make all of this work. I live in one of the poorest places in the state of Minnesota. I understand that we have a lot of things and there's a lot of great things and a lot of people have been helped by this. I just want you to understand that this is difficult for folks to pay for. I understand it's important. It's difficult, especially in poorer parts of the state of Minnesota. And to put that in context, this does cause more difficulty for our business office because we don't get money for this. We do have to do some extra things within our office to make this go. The third thing I want to say is that on this one is that the way this is working out is that I have people who are telling me they don't want to work because they can do this and not work. Where I am, we need people to work. And I know there's some rules, like, for et cetera, but what's happening is that, and you have to put in the context, my phone is going off like crazy today. 600 range workers are out of a job because the mining companies just laid them off. How long? I don't know. But we have 2,300 kids. You don't have to be a statistician to figure this one out. One out of every four of our kids has a mom or a father or a grandpa or a grandma who doesn't have a job. This is tough. So what's happening is that we have, in order to pay for, and we do appreciate the funding stream of what you're doing, we have people who are not working, and we have to pay for them to not work. But the way it's working right now, I have to cut teachers, welcome to my world, to pay for paying people not to work. And I've got 600 iron workers who are out of a job. Please, if this is important, please find a stable funding stream for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Next up, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and co-chair, and members. My name is Kat Briggs, and I'm a school bus driver for Independent School District 196. I'm so grateful that education support professionals like me have access to unemployment compensation in the summer. I have the same basic economic security as my sons, who both work construction, pouring concrete, and when they can't work in the winter, they get unemployment. Driving a bus is not an easy job. We're basically driving a one-room schoolhouse through traffic and phone texting and snow. It's extra tough in the summer, not just because there's no air conditioning in the majority of buses, During the summer, I work 1 to 2 hours early in the morning and 2 more hours in the afternoon, a split shift, if you will, 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. That's only 16 hours of work. And of course, when there's no work, the weeks when there's no school, I receive no income. Because of unemployment insurance, the weeks when there was school, I received a partial unemployment benefit along with my wages. The weeks when there were no routes, I received my full benefit, which is about half of my weekly school year income. That little bit of economic security meant that I didn't have to choose between taking care of my school children, and they're my school children, and my grandbabies during the summer. I was able to budget and afford the gas to drive to Kenyon, to Faribault, to take care of my grandchildren when I did not have work available to me during the summer. It is critical that we have the best people to transport our most precious cargo, our kids. Children need consistency in their lives. What better way to show consistency than to have the same bus drivers, chaperones, paras, food service, and other staff each and every year? It is no coincidence that after the fall, in the fall, when the UI law changed, was the first time in a long time you did not hear about the back-to-school staffing crisis in the news. It's easier to retain staff, especially new drivers, and hard to fill jobs, like summer school. Now that workers won't be asked to go from financial crisis to financial crisis with no safety net. Now, I'm a conservative, and my other half also farms. I'm very skeptical about property taxes, but I support this bill, giving districts the authority to use their UI levy. Doesn't mean that they have to use it. In 196, where I live and work, it's the third largest district in the state and growing. Our UI costs last year were less than $1.5 million. Even if the school board decides to put that all on the levy, I'm not concerned about the impact that spreads out across the entire district in property tax. That's something I can afford. During COVID lockdown, people told us how much they appreciated our work. But for most of us, it was just lip service. Laws like unemployment insurance, earned sick and safe time, and paid family leave and medical act were more than lip service. Minnesota showed us that you value us and the work we do. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony and what you do for our kids. Let's see who we have. We have about 5 minutes for questions, but we also have experts in the audience that you can touch base with afterwards. But I think I'll just kick it over to Rep. Lee. Did you have a question? Or Rep. Johnson?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Ream, for bringing this bill. In this committee, we've heard a lot about mandates and costs and things like this. I think this bill helps get us to that point of funding that out so that we can be more prepared as we go into the future and what that looks like. As far as questions that I have is can you think of any reasons whatsoever that this class of workers should have been paired out or continue to be tried to be paired out of unemployment insurance? That's a lot of the testimony we got is this cost of people who don't want to work when so many other industries, including those folks up in the Iron Range that just got laid off, will be eligible for this benefit.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pete Johnston, for that question. So this is the situation that we're facing is that a lot of these workers have not been eligible for unemployment insurance. They're the one class of workers that haven't been given this opportunity and haven't gotten these benefits. And I do want to speak to something that an earlier testifier had pointed out, and maybe I can have other people also testify to this, but if you receive unemployment insurance, it's because you have been actively seeking employment and your school district does not have a comparable job for you. It's not like you can willy-nilly say, I want unemployment insurance this summer and I'm going to take it. You actually have to be looking for a position and looking for, you know, and hopefully the school district would have a position for you, because if you do get work during the summer from the school district, they will pay you full. If they don't, you only get half of your pay. You don't get full pay. You only get half. So, and I guess, you know, when we're thinking about districts that don't, you know, they might be in danger of not passing a levy to increase funding for the schools. You know, I have to say, I don't want the people who work on our buses, the people who are driving our kids to and from school, the cafeteria workers, I don't want these people to be the ones that have to bear the burden of these costs. I don't think that's fair. You know, it's disproportionately women who take these jobs. And so I think this is leveling the playing field for people, and that this way we can make sure that everyone is compensated fairly. And like I said, no one is taking unemployment insurance and getting 100% of their regular pay. They're getting half at best.
Thank you, Representative Members. We've been told that we can't go overtime, and we've got like 2 minutes, and I had Hudson, Mueller, Bakeberg, and then Kreisha to wrap up, but I'll go to Hudson and then Chair Kreisha to wrap up. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're very short on time, so I'll try to keep it brief. Listen, the comment was made that these mandates that have been passed recently are more than lip service. It shows that we care. Well, showing that we care would be actually providing the funding to back up the mandates. When we don't fund it and we just tell school districts you have to do this, and this bill does that, says a couple years from now, you're going to have to take on this burden, that's not showing that we care. That's showing that we're willing to take credit for something that somebody else is going to pay for. That's what we've heard tonight from Mr. Schmidt, and we've seen many other anecdotes, but I'll spare you those given time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Chair Kreisch?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill up to the bill author and to all the testifiers. I'll just leave it at this. Members, the two bills we heard here, we don't even come close to being able to afford with the current surplus we have. We're a finance committee that has a finite amount of money, and Representative Hudson mentioned the anecdotes, and I'll bring that back a bit. This is as much anecdotes as anything. We hear good and bad about it. The reality is, are we going to be able to afford this program? And when people talk about stable funding doesn't just necessarily mean that there's stable positive money. Stable funding could mean the program goes away and there's no liabilities with funding attached to it. So we have to look at whether or not we can afford this. And the other question is, if we put this on the levies, I'll say it here, you are going to divide school districts across this state, pushing this down to school boards. We're going to have hard conversations with voters. And folks, go look at the school board elections right now. Go look at the fact that a group of senators broke off and called themselves blue dogs. They get the changing conversations at communities. This won't help that, and I think this makes us more divisive.
Thank you, Chair Kreisch. I'm sure we're going to have much more conversation as we lay House File 2020-10 over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. I'm sorry, Representative Freeman, I didn't give you time to wrap up, but we have to get going. Members, Chair Kreisch has the gavel on Tuesday, and I'm sure we'll be seeing the agenda pretty soon. And with that, we are adjourned.